The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 134.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone to the Rebel Capitalist Show that I've really looked forward to. We always say buy things when they're cheap and sell them when they're expensive. But what on earth right now is cheap? So we've got the chief investment strategist with sovereignman.com. His name is Tim Starmos. Am I saying that right, Tim?
Stamos, yeah, it's a Danish name. It's okay. Unusual.
Great. We've got Tim here, and he invests all over the world. He's been doing this for many years. So he's going to start off by giving us his background and then outlining what he's investing in, what he's looking at right now across the entire world that is actually cheap. So this is going to be fantastic. Tim, welcome to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Thank you very much, George. Great to be here with you. And yeah, as you say, I have a very international background. I've been living in Asia since about 1996, so that's gone on 25 years. I grew up in Australia, lived all over the world before that. I was sort of an expat brat. My father had a job that took him to various places around the world, including Africa, Europe, Singapore. But in 1996, I started my career in South Korea in the equities markets there as a researcher, equity research, and I haven't left Asia since. At the moment, I'm in my place down in Bali. I have a base in Hong Kong. I used to live in Manila in the Philippines, as well as South Korea before that. So I've been around the traps. But in a way, my life's kind of come full circle. I'm headed back to Tanzania on Friday, actually. I just booked the tickets, and that's where I was born. My parents were there as overseas volunteers back in the early 70s, and I came along. Not sure whether that was planned or not, but it doesn't matter. And I was back in Tanzania 2 years ago, 2018, to climb Mount Kilimanjaro, and I started looking around at the stock market there. And I wasn't even sure whether it was possible for non-Tanzanians to invest. But I read a column there in one of the local business papers, and I got in touch with the fellow who'd written it. He was a strategist at one of the local brokerage firms, and got talking to him, and he confirmed that it was possible for foreigners to invest. There's no restrictions, and I kind of took it from there. But if I rewind a bit, I first went back there back in 2018, a couple of years ago, to climb Kilimanjaro with a bunch of friends. And as part of that, I also stayed in the commercial capital, Dar es Salaam, for a while. And while I was there, I started, you know, I'm a stock market geek. Wherever I go in the world, I like to pick up the local business newspaper and turn to the back and see what the stock prices are doing. I didn't even know they had a stock market, but I worked out that they did. And I made contact with the head of research at one of the local brokerages who writes a regular column for the paper I was reading. And, you know, he confirmed that it's possible for non-Tanzanians to invest in the market, no restrictions, you know, money can come in and out, no capital controls, none of that funny stuff. And I found stocks that were, you know, ridiculously cheap. And
so when you say cheap, how are you defining that, Tim?
Okay, so I'm a pretty traditional value investor, and I'm looking to buy things that create good returns on capital. I mean, that's my first objective. I want to buy a quality business that's generating, you know, somewhere in the teens for every dollar that it employs in its business. And then I want to buy that at a low multiple of equity value. So, you know, I mean, more people probably thinking in terms of price earnings and earnings yields, things like that. I'll give you an idea. The one of the banks I own there is trading at between 2 and 3 times earnings. About half book value, yields in the low teens. There's a cement company I own there that's trading between 5 and 6 times earnings, yields about 13.5%. And these are, you know, these are not little fly-by-night businesses. These are the dominant companies in their industries in the country. And unfortunately, there's not many of them. It's a small market. There are about 17 listed stocks in Tanzania. And only about half a dozen of those are large enough for me to be interested, but they're trading at these, you know, incredibly attractive valuations. Now, there are reasons for that, and obviously macro factors are very important in these frontier and emerging markets, as you well know. Perception of the risk that exists to me is much greater than the actual risk, however, if you delve into it. I mean, you've done stuff in Colombia. I'm sure that, you know, people that don't know, and you say that you're running around doing stuff there, they probably say, "Oh, are you crazy? You know, the risk must be enormous." And in actual fact,
I'm going to get decapitated. I'm going to get kidnapped. Yeah, exactly. It's all drug dealers.
yeah. You know the drill. And but you know, so in Tanzania, there's political issues at the moment. There's a lot of Westerners that don't like what the current administration's doing. But to me, that's all just noise. And if you're focusing on the long-term value of these businesses that are just pounding out returns, as I said to my brother-in-law, you know, I don't really mind if they don't go up in price anytime soon, because if I'm collecting dividends in the low teens, I can afford to wait a long time for the macro perceptions to change and for the money to come back in. But
so
Tanzania,
what's the currency risk there, though, Tim?
Yeah, so that's the big one. Currency and then liquidity. You know, it's hard to get in and out of these things without moving the prices too much. And currency, it tends to depreciate slowly over time against the U.S. dollar in the case of the Tanzanian shilling. They use a shilling there. But, you know, it's not a case of crazy gyrations the way that you have in some of the commodity producing countries in Africa, Angola, you know, Nigeria, very dependent on oil, and Nigeria at the moment has currency issues, and it's actually a market that I would like to invest in, but I can't touch it at the moment based on my rules and the instability with the currency. But going back to Tanzania, it sort of depreciates at a couple of a percent a year if you work it out over long cycles and you smooth it. And I say to people, we just have to factor that in to our model. And if we're looking to compound our money at around 15% per annum, which I think is possible in a market like that, then we, you know, in US dollar terms, then we just need to compound it at 17-18% in you know, in local terms, and then by the time you translate it back, you're still doing fine. I mean, give you an idea, people think Tanzania must be, you know, sort of a crazy place in terms of the macroeconomic fundamentals. Not really. You know, the government bond there, the long bond, yields about 14%. Inflation rate is between 3 and 4, so you got a 10-11% real yield. The debt to GDP ratio is only about 35%. I think it's just gone above 100 in the US, so it's one third of the level in the US. No crazy inflation. So for the moment, certainly it's stable. And you know, that is obviously something that you're cognizant of as a frontier investor. You got to keep an eye on the macro and make sure that things aren't about to go pear-shaped. But I just don't see that in the case of Tanzania. One of their biggest exports is actually gold. So at the moment, they're in a pretty good spot. Tanzania and Ghana are the two big gold exporters in Africa. And tourism isn't doing so well because of the COVID-19 issues. Tanzania is open, but a lot of the neighboring countries are not. And obviously people that would ordinarily go on holiday in Tanzania and spend lots of foreign exchange there, Europeans, Americans, they aren't going because of the quarantine requirements when they return home. It's not that Tanzania has said you can't come, but there are issues at the moment. So tourism is down this year, but gold is way up. And the other big export that they have is agriculture. So it's a fairly balanced economy. It's kind of like a three-legged stool in terms of the foreign exchange earnings. And there's only one leg that's a little bit iffy at the moment, and that's tourism. But it'll come back. You know, these things have a way of righting themselves. And in that whole neighborhood, you know, it's pretty interesting.
When you're doing this research and... I'm assuming you kind of take a macro, like a top-down approach. The first thing you start with is you kind of look at the fundamentals of the country itself. And then once there's something there that crosses your or comes onto your radar, then you're like, okay, let me dig a little deeper and see if there's some companies here that I really like. And then you start looking at the individual balance sheets, the P&Ls, and all those things. Is that kind of your process? And if so, how do you scan for these countries? How did Tanzania come across your radar?
Yeah. So, yeah, I have a, I guess you call it a barbell approach has become the fashionable term in that I focus a lot on the macro at the one end and then a lot on the micro at the other end. But without the right macro conditions, you're right. It's pretty, you know, useless digging down to the micro level. So I'll give you an idea. If at the other end of the scale, I mentioned Nigeria at the moment is a problem for me because that big macro factor, the foreign exchange rate risk, basically means that I eliminate it for the time being from my list of places where I want to do micro research. Same in Zimbabwe, which unfortunately, you know, great country, but terribly governed and has been in hyperinflation now for the better part of a decade. It's also a market where I just can't touch the local stock market, even though the stock market's actually gone up a lot in recent years. That's in local currency terms, and no one really knows what the Zimbabwean currency is at the moment. You know, some say it's dollarized, some say that they're on this you know, RGTS thing that they brought in. I mean, it's a total mess. There's a lot of guys running around trying to bring in cryptocurrencies, actually, which is probably a conversation for another day. But it's also on the list of too hard to deal with from the macro. And then Zambia is the third country that's in my universe at the moment, which has a lot of issues from the macro. They've borrowed far too much money and far too much of it from China. So there's probably a risk of actually a sovereign default there. So, yeah. So basically, it's a process of elimination. I cut out the countries that are too risky from a macro standpoint. And then the countries that are stable and the business conditions are reasonably attractive, I then go in and start looking at the local companies. And we have a universe of about 496 companies, I think it is, just under 500. And just one point that I want to make is I'm not looking at South Africa. South Africa is sort of like the 400-pound gorilla in this part of the world. Right. So my fund is focused on sub-Saharan Africa, ex-South Africa. So it's a bit like here in Asia back in the day when the emerging markets investors first started coming out to Asia. They would put Japan in a separate basket from the rest because Japan was so much further advanced and such a big market. But then going to the micro level, you know, it's, I like to say it's simple, but it's not easy. You know, it's just hard work filtering through annual reports. And I have a philosophy that I go straight to the horse's mouth, as it were, and go to the company announcements themselves. It's great to read brokers' reports and other things after I've looked at the raw data myself and kind of formed an impression. That's my research process. I like to basically read announcements that companies have made to the stock exchange, you know, quarterly filings, whatever it is that they're required to do from a statutory standpoint, and reading, you know, the annual reports that they've put out on their own websites, and get a feel for it that way. There are a few good screening tools as well available online, you know, that don't cost too much. A lot of people are kind of surprised that as a professional money manager, I don't use Bloomberg or anything like that. There are a lot of guys who are addicted to their Bloombergs and, you know, they'd be totally lost without them. For one reason or another, I never developed that habit. And I have various other sources online that are, you know, as reliable. They're just not as easy, I guess, to get all the information in one spot. But over the years, I've you know, built up a whole bunch of resources. There's a great new one out called Finbox. I have no affiliation with them whatsoever, but I like their data screening, and it's a new one that I came across recently. I think it's based on S&P data. And for these frontier markets, you know, you go into stuff that people might be using, Yahoo Finance or things like that. They're not going to help you. You got to really find the data in more specialized databases.
And Finbox has data on all.
Yeah, surprisingly. I think it's based on S&P data. And obviously, S&P constructs a lot of indices, frontier market indices. So okay. I found it to be very good. You know, there's a lot of stuff from the Caribbean and Africa and Latin America that you don't get in other places from there. But there are a few specialist African sites as well. African Markets is one that I use. and then African Financials. So you, there are portals where you can go and pick up the micro information for analysis without having to sort of jump around from each country's stock exchange to the next.
When you've isolated a country as cheap, and or the fundamentals look good, let's say, from a macro, and then you find companies that, that are cheap, what's the catalyst? Because the argument is always going to be, well, how do we know they're not going to just stay cheap at the same PE for the next 10 years? You know, they've been like this for 10 years. No one's discovered them. So why should someone, or why should capital come into the market over the next 10 years? Do you wait for a catalyst? And if so, kind of what are the things that you look for?
Okay, that's a very valid point. And I mean, you introduced me before. I've been writing a newsletter for Sovereign Man as well, called The Fourth Pillar, for quite a while. And one of our strategies there is to buy deep value stocks that are trading at less than the net cash that they have on the balance sheet. And we run all sorts of screens, and we eliminate money losing things and whatever. But you're quite right. You do run the risk of buying things and then just being stuck holding them, you know, forever and a day, because there's never any catalyst.
Right.
I like to say that, you know, your return as an investor depends on three things: what you buy at, what you sell at, and how long you've held the investment for.
Right.
And you can add in maybe, you know, what dividends it's paid you during the time, which is very important in the case of these African stocks. But as a value investor, unfortunately, the only thing you can control out of those three variables are, or is, what you pay. And that's why, as a traditional value investor, that's what I'm really focused on, is to pay the least amount possible and to have the biggest margin of safety that I can. Because you never know when the price is going to move. And I've yet to meet someone who's good at picking catalysts consistently. But, you know, they're around. It's been a very hard slog in recent years as a value investor, because there's seemingly been fewer and fewer catalysts in this space. I mean, all the money sort of flowing to momentum and growth, and nothing really coming in for the mean reversion strategies that have worked in the past. But I just have to believe that eventually that changes, as it always has in the past. I mean, I've been doing this stuff for 25 years, so I've seen probably three market cycles now. It feels very much like we're at the top of a market cycle where, you know, the big dominant growth stocks have had an impressive run, and you know, they're putting up crazy numbers, and value has just been completely ignored, not just in Africa, but also in other markets around the world. So I'm not looking specifically for catalysts.
Okay.
Just want to buy stuff that is of a high quality. And dividends are very important to me. So
that's my next question. Yeah.
Yeah. So that I have the ability to wait out the time period where I'm waiting for a catalyst. You know, going back to the example of these two companies in Tanzania I spoke about just before, the bank and the cement company. I mean, if you're getting paid 13% a year in dividends to wait, you're already doing pretty well. You know, you don't really need a lot of money washing in to push the price up in the short term. Although I think that's what eventually happens. You know, these things go in and out of fashion. There were a bunch of people who set up frontier market funds and African market funds sort of in the early part of this decade. You know, South Africa had the World Cup in 2010, and Africa was in the news, and people did get the idea that it was, you know, time to go in and buy stuff there because it was cheap. But it kind of fizzled. You know, there was a great period, 2011 through 2014, where a lot of money did wash in and prices did go up. So there was a catalyst there where people discovered the value, as it were. But then it all kind of fell apart, and things dropped in price until sort of 2017. There was another rally into 2018. And since 2018, it's all been sort of going down again. So the benchmark that I'm using for the fund I just set up, it's an S&P Sub-Saharan Africa frontier market benchmark. It's actually gone nowhere in 10 years if you look at the whole period, but it had a period where it went up 120% and then it went back down again, and then, you know, so it's kind of cyclical. But I feel pretty comfortable at the moment that prices are so low and dividend yields are so attractive that I can buy and I can be a strong hand and hold until I get the next wave of money coming in that re-rates the valuations. And one of the catalysts for that could be, since we're talking about catalysts, could be that the U.S. dollar finally, you know, tops out and has a bear market, which I know there's a lot of debate. You know, you and I are both sort of in that FinTwit community, and there's always good discussions going on between people. Is the dollar going to go up, or, you know, the dollar shake theory, or is it going to collapse? And I don't know. I mean, I'm not a macro guy in that sense. I don't try and predict currency trends. But it's delicately poised at the moment, for sure. You know, the obviously the DXY index is not that representative. It's mostly euro and yen and pounds. But, you know, as a rule of thumb, that's the one I probably check up on. And I see it was at a critical level last week around 92. But, you know, traditionally, if the dollar has been in a weak phase, then emerging markets and frontier markets have tended to do well. So that's one possibility. The other possibility is that, you know, value comes back into fashion more generally. I mean, how much longer can Apple keep doubling its market cap? You know, eventually it'll be, you know, worth 90% of the entire world. You know, this is crazy. Yeah. It was a trillion. And then it went to $2 trillion about a year later, right? I mean, it's just incredible. Good luck to the people that have held on to Apple. I mean,
I don't know if you saw that Zero Hedge tweet the other day, but they said something to the effect that Apple stock went up an entire Exxon in the last 48 hours.
There you go. And they removed Exxon from the Dow, and, you know, to get more tech in there. And that was another thing I wrote about recently. I write a blog as well at globalvaluehunter.com, and I actually wrote a piece on, you know, the removal of Exxon from the Dow. And, you know, how, you know, I mean, indexing is great, and it means you're never going to underperform, but it's kind of a rigged game in my mind. You know, it's a little bit bizarre the way it all goes. But no, going back to that relative market capitalization thing, so an interesting fact that I put in my African Lions Fund presentation that I gave earlier in the week that just popped back into my head is that of these 496 companies that are in my research universe in sub-Saharan Africa, if you add the market value up, it's only about $82 billion U.S. dollars. And that's about the same as American Express. Or the same as HSBC Holdings, or if you're in Australia, the same as the Commonwealth Bank. So basically, the entire market capitalization of these countries is only the same as one sort of, you know, run-of-the-mill company in the U.S. Apple is 20 times bigger than these markets combined. I mean, it's nuts.
Yeah, so that goes back to liquidity. And when you're buying, especially if you got a sizable position that you want to execute, how do you not move the market? How does that work? And then what do you want to sell? I mean, where's your buyer?
Yeah, so it's very much a risk factor at this stage in the market cycle where things are cheap and bombed out and there's not a lot of trading going on. I have a fair amount of experience with illiquid stocks, and it doesn't faze me. I have to make sure I have the right kind of investors in my fund, though. I mean, I don't want people that need the ability to sort of turn on a dime and get back out. We have a quarterly redemption, and people do have to give us fair warning. So I try and address it that way structurally. But the other thing is that if these markets do come back into fashion, you know, that will change because you will have more money around buying and selling. I think I'm probably going to have a difficult time, you know, putting the money to work here initially without moving prices. But I have no intention of, you know, wading in like a big whale and pushing prices up. So I'll just bide my time and carefully accumulate. But then I'll be there and I'll be ready. And if there is a big wave of liquidity that comes in and pushes prices up, you know, I'll be a seller. I'll be able to trim my positions and sell into that. I've done a lot of speculating in small cap mining stocks in Australia over the years as well. And that's exactly the pattern that you see there. You know, when these stocks are bombed out and out of favor, it's very difficult to even buy any because people have sold and the guys that are still holding, they're the strong hands and they just wait.
Right.
And, you know, you carefully accumulate a position and then there's nothing to do except wait for a liquidity wave. And then, you know, the company might make an acquisition, inject a new asset, or they may be out drilling and they drill into something exciting and then the market spikes and there'll be a wave of money that comes towards this stock. So I'm the guy who's had it all that time and sells into the spike and provides the liquidity to the market that you know, these guys need as they come in. So I'm kind of viewing Africa in the same light at the moment, although it's a longer term thing. I mean, just to be clear, I'm thinking very long term here. As I say, I've been in Asia for the past 25 years, so that's an entire generation, and I'm kind of thinking intergenerationally with the Africa opportunity as well.
So your time horizon's 10 plus years.
Yeah, I mean, I say to the fund investors, 5 to 10 years minimum. If you're sort of not patient enough to wait at least 5 years for this thesis to prove out, then it's probably not for you. But ideally, 10 years and up. And we haven't got into that yet, but that's another reason that I'm very bullish on Africa for the longer term is just the demographics are changing in a very interesting way. And again, it's the parallel with Asia is amazing. If you look at the population pyramid in Asia, the way it looked in 1970, so 50 yep. years ago, and I have some of this material online if people are interested, and it's a bit difficult to follow when I'm just talking you through it, but the population pyramid basically looks like that, which means you got lots of young people, kids down at the bottom, and very few old people. That was Asia in 1970. And you look at Africa now and it looks exactly the same. I mean, it's uncanny. And what happened then in Asia was as the countries grew more wealthy, people had fewer kids, the kids that were already around started going into the workforce as they grew older. And the population, the workforce in Asia basically tripled from just under a billion to nearly 3 billion over the last 40, 50 years. And obviously that unleashed a huge boom as these people became productive and there were fewer people dependent on the workers. So you had lots of workers and less kids for each worker. And that's kind of what created the Asian boom in my mind. I mean, there are a lot of other factors at play and Africa is not exactly the same. But it's a movie that I've seen before. The script will be slightly different, but the general plot looks the same to me. And in Africa, you're going to get not quite the same degree because Asia was bigger to begin with, but you're going to get a doubling of the workforce over the next generation. And the number of kids will stay relatively constant. So people are going to enter their peak earning and consuming years. I mean, you know, people turning 18, getting their first job, you know, drinking their first beer, getting their first mobile phone, you know, getting their first apartment of their own. I mean, it's really quite a bullish long-term story as long as the macro environment can stay relatively benign and the governance of the countries can keep improving as it has been.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
That's what I wanted to touch on next is you got obviously a huge tailwind with the demographics.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
You have a headwind that's going to act as a counterbalance to that from a standpoint of the political environment. Because I think that's kind of always the knock on Africa, isn't it?
Yeah, and people sort of have a perception that's not always entirely accurate. So I guess the first point there is, you know, we talk of Africa, it's a continent, you know, it's not a country. A lot of people think and I'm guilty of the same thing. But it's very diverse. You know, there's 54 different countries and everything from Morocco to Madagascar to Mauritius, very, very different, you know, politically, geographically, and the populations as well. So that's the first point that, yeah, there are plenty of basket cases and there probably always will be. But a lot of those I've already eliminated from, you know, either they don't have stock markets. You know, there's only, of the 54 countries, there's only 24 stock markets. Yeah. So immediately 30 countries are not investable in my universe because I'm a listed equity investor. There's people running around doing private equity and real estate as well, which is a whole different thing. But
going back to Asia, when you're talking about the demographics being very similar, was the political environment overall seen as just as unstable back then as Africa is seen now?
Yeah, that's the thing. A lot of people lose sight of the fact that, you know, democracy and stability has certainly not been a feature of the Asian economies during the time that they has had this entire boom. I think we're sort of guilty in the West of equating freedom and democracy with the right conditions for economic growth, where if you look objectively at the data, that's not actually the case. A lot of the most successful economic development stories were in countries that were run by, you know, benevolent dictators, for want of a better word. Yeah, Singapore is the one that's held up as the most prime example of that. But here in Indonesia, where I am, you know, it developed under Suharto, even though he was probably not a very nice guy in some respects. He at least had a long-term vision for the country, and he was in power long enough that he could make a difference. You know, he could think long-term. Same with the Communist Party in China. You know, they do all sorts of nasty things, and I'm in no agreement with what they're doing out in Xinjiang and all the horror stories that you hear. But, you know, give them credit for at least having a economic development vision that seems to have worked and being able to implement that and build lots of infrastructure. So, you know, there are plenty of democracies in Africa, and there's lots of good news stories. I mean, we tend to hear only the bad news about Africa in the Western media. But even the Congo recently held an election where the opposition guy got in. You know, that's a country that's always been a basket case. And, you know, Tanzania traditionally has been very stable, just to go back to my favorite place there. But Kenya is a vibrant democracy. Over in West Africa, there are countries that have been run by the same guy for a long time, which you know, are stable for that reason, and investors like stability. But you know, in Asia, South Korea was run by a dictator until the early 80s. You know, Indonesia, I just mentioned, probably the only country that's always had some form of democracy is the Philippines, and you know, it's been a basket case for a lot of that time after they got rid of Marcos, who was a dictator. But recently they've done well. So, you know, this idea that democracy equals economic growth is simply not true. And that's the reason that
I remember reading something to the effect that there was a city, and I want to say it was the capital city of Tanzania, where this article was implying that their objective was to be like the next, or the Singapore of Africa, where they're trying to keep it.
You're thinking of Rwanda. Yeah. So Rwanda, the president of Rwanda has a very clear vision. And, you know, Rwanda is infamous for its genocide in the early 90s, 1994, which was turned into a movie. But the country's come, you know, complete circle since then. And a lot of the younger people, you know, again, going back to that population pyramid, lots of young people in Africa. The young people there don't have any memory of those terrible things, and it's a country that's really moving forward. But the president there, Kagame, he's very much a fan of Lee Kuan Yew's economic development model in Singapore, and he's modeling a lot of what he's trying to do for Rwanda on that. And they've had great success. You know, they're growing at 6% a year and have been for over a decade. You know, they're outward looking.
Do you see that as maybe an opportunity as well?
Definitely, yeah. I actually wrote about it at Global Value Hunter last week, I guess it was. And it's a tiny place. There's really only four or five companies that are listed on the exchange there, so I hope that picks up. but you know, the biggest banking group there and the biggest beverage company are two that are on my radar for sure. You know, they're high quality businesses. Again, the liquidity means that they're very difficult to buy in quantity. The brewery there, the beverage company, is a subsidiary of Heineken. And people that own the stock, they're quite happy just to hang on to it. And not a lot of it comes loose for trading on the market. And that's another feature, actually, of these businesses in Africa that I'm looking to invest in. A lot of them are very professionally run. You know, they're subsidiaries of multinationals. They've got deep roots in the country. They're good corporate citizens, big taxpayers. So the governments love them. You know, they're like the goose that lays the golden eggs. So you have some people think, oh, well, you know, won't the government come and steal the businesses and appropriate them? And aren't there risks like that? Not in the history of what I've seen. You know, it's really not an issue at all. And that's also a thing that I'm focused on in the micro investing or the micro analysis that I do is, you know, who are the shareholders in the company that we're investing in? You know, are they good corporate citizens? Are they people that we want to be in business with? And a lot of them end up being these multinational subsidiaries, which gives me some comfort.
The next question that would come to my mind is just going back to what you're saying earlier with this this basket of stocks that you were tracking, this index, how it went up by like 110% or so and then came back down. So what is your strategy for knowing when to sell? I think that's, as investors, we get so hyper-focused on what business to buy and if it's going up or down in price. And then we forget that, okay, if it doubles, well, great, but what do you do? Do you keep it? Do you sell it? Or so what's your strategy for knowing when to sell?
Very good point. So I tend to have a strategy where I trim positions as they're going up. But I have a very strict rule that before I even buy something, I want to know in what circumstances I will sell. So I have an exit strategy before even entering an investment. And that's across the board. But with value stocks, obviously, if I'm buying them cheap, what I'm looking at is not just the price. I'm you know, measuring the operational metrics of the business. I mean, that's really what I'm focused on. And as long as the business continues to do what I thought it would be doing when I made the initial decision, in other words, it's continuing to generate an acceptable return on capital, that's kind of my benchmark. And if the price of the stock is going up, obviously that means that you can no longer buy that business at a low multiple. But as long as the business continues to generate great returns on capital and there's nothing that's a red flag in terms of the operational environment, I'm comfortable to hold. Now, that said, as a fund manager, you do have to bank profits from time to time, and there's going to be people that are going to be looking to redeem from the fund, so you need some cash lying around. And traditionally, my strategy has been to take partial profits along the way if we've had a good rally in something. So, you know, rules of thumb people use, if it's doubled, take your initial capital off the table, stuff like that. I'm not necessarily thinking in those terms with value stocks in Africa, but certainly in terms of mining stocks, mining exploration companies, that's what I tend to do. You need to be able to hold things that multi-bag to really make the big money in these markets over the long run. So hopefully I won't have to sell you know, too much along the way, and we can all be long-term investors and do well. But very much trimming positions is my strategy.
I think the key there is you're buying these stocks as though you're buying the entire business.
That's right.
You know, we always hear, oh, well, sure, Ben Graham tells us to do that, Warren Buffett tells us to, but no one really does it in practice. They just get hyper focused on buying a stock certificate and hopes that next week it goes up and they've quote unquote made a good decision. But I always use the example, and I think I've got a huge edge here just from a mental standpoint, because I was an entrepreneur all the way up into 2012 when I retired. Yep. And I always use the example of a McDonald's. And I would never, if I was going to go buy a McDonald's, I would just look at the P&L. I don't even know if I'd be concerned with the balance sheet too much, you know, depending on, we won't go into that, but I'd start with the P&L and I'd say, okay, well, how much money are they making? What's coming to their bottom line every single year? And then how much money would I have to borrow to buy this or use cash, whatever, and you calculate. Yep. And then you buy it because you're buying the entire business. If the broker came to me in 2 weeks and said, oh my gosh, you know what? I just analyzed this business again. And I think that you could get an extra 10%. Like, are you going to sell the McDonald's? No, you just bought it 2 weeks ago.
Exactly. That's right. Yeah. And then what are you going to do with the money? You know, it's a game of hot potato in that case. So if you own a great business, why would you sell it? So it's very much so. Yeah.
So you talked about what your mindset is for selling and that you're looking at the fundamentals. Am I correct to assume it would be the same for when you exit a position because it's just not working? And you're like, okay, I made a mistake and the fundamentals go against you. Now all of a sudden they're doing, you know, the change management or something. And then you're like, okay, I need to pull the ripcord here on this one.
Yeah. So it's probably even more important to have an exit strategy for error trades. And it's the same criteria. So I may have made a mistake in my analysis and thought that the company had a durable competitive advantage, but along comes a competitor and there's a price war, and all of a sudden the returns on capital that the company I bought is generating is half of what I had predicted my long-term analysis. And, you know, then obviously I would sell the position and move on to the next one. And I guess the other point about when to sell is, you know, if you're a value investor, there may be stuff that's even better value than something you bought, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, which is re-rated.
Right.
And then you might rotate. But I'm only looking to hold between 10 and 20 businesses. That's really my objective here. So I have a universe that's just under 500, 496 was what I said earlier. And I'm really probably that's narrowed down to about 60 or 70 that are in my continuous monitoring universe for research. And of those 60 or 70, I only want to own 10 or 20 at any one time.
Then you just watch them very carefully.
Yeah, that's right. So it's about monitoring the businesses more than the price. You know, everyone is fixated on price in the stock market, which, you know, that's the seductive thing. The number changes minute by minute. And everyone, you know, that's all anyone ever asks me is about price. They never ask me about, well, how's the company you bought into doing? You know, that's the real question. You know, is the cement company that you bought 2 years ago in Tanzania, you know, bringing home the bacon? Is it delivering on what you thought it did? And yeah, I mean, that's what I'm focused on. You know,
exactly. But it goes back to the McDonald's. You know,
if I just
met you at a dinner party, we're having a beer, and you're like, I own a couple McDonald's franchises, I'd say, oh, great. Well, how'd you do last year? Meaning, you know, how much money did you make, or how much profit your profits were up by 10% or whatever. You wouldn't say, oh, you know what? I had my business broker evaluate the business and I could sell it for 20% more than I paid for it.
That's what people do in stocks. I just don't get it. All right. But it's a structural thing, you know.
One thing I wanted to ask you about is, and I'm sure this is on everyone's mind right now, is how could the average or quote unquote average investor get into the, I mean, if they have like an interactive broker account, are these stocks that they could potentially buy, or is the only way to go through?
No. So
what do you think?
Unfortunately, it's very difficult to access the markets that I'm looking at, the frontier markets in Africa. There are probably, you could probably buy South African stocks and on some of these international platforms, but very few of the other markets are available. And it's not cheap either. Like, a lot of these places are still stuck in the dinosaur age in terms of, you know, minimum brokerage commissions and things like that. I mean, you'd be shocked at some of the brokerage commissions we have to pay. But there are some places you can access more than just the one market. There's a broker in South Africa called Momentum Securities, you know, as in, you know, momentum strategy that everyone's got working for them at the moment.
Yeah.
And it's a South African broker that offers access to a lot of other African markets. So that's the only one I can really think of off the top of my head for a self-directed investor that wants to have a one-stop shop that they would be worth looking at. Interactive Brokers is a great shop as well, but they don't do these markets at all, as far as I'm aware. So what I've actually written about for people at my Global Value Hunter website, and that's my Twitter handle as well, by the way, Global Value at Global Value Hunt. I've said to people, I'm happy to share my information with brokers that you can go to directly in these markets, but you really need to set up individual accounts in those countries, sort of more in the Jim Rogers fashion. You know, when he did his trips around the world, he would open a brokerage account in, along the way in each country where it was possible. And he still has a lot of those accounts, I know from speaking with Jim. So that's kind of the strategy that I would advise people that are a bit more adventurous and want to do it independently. And then, of course, I've set up this fund for the people who are not able to spend the time and effort to do that on their own. We have a turkey solution, as it were.
Do you have to be an accredited investor for your fund, Tim?
No, you don't, actually. It's a British Virgin Islands structure called a private fund. So
okay.
The offer has to be made privately. So I can't really, you know, talk too much about it here.
Oh, but sure. Okay.
We have a website where people can register, AfricanLionsFund.com.
Okay.
I kind of picked the name African Lions Fund because I've been living here in Asia and I grew up hearing all about the Asian tiger economy. So it was kind of a logical, logical
name.
We can, unfortunately, at this stage, we haven't sort of registered as investment advisors in the United States. I'm looking into doing that so that I can take more US clients. But at the moment, we have a cap on the number of US clients we can take for that reason. But you don't have to be an accredited investor. Because we have that cap, however, I have to be commercial about it. So I probably have to take the biggest investors that come in under that cap for now. But I'm keeping a waiting list of people that are interested. And certainly we have plans to make it more accessible to a wider audience. Once it's up and running and paying its own way, then it'll be worth our while to set it up so that we can access investors in the U.S. But the minimum is only $25,000. So I've tried to make it accessible to people, although most people are putting in a fair bit more than that. But, you know, to get a toehold is only $25,000.
Yeah, and I'd also like to point out to people that might be saying to themselves, oh, great, there's no way I could ever set up a brokerage account in some crazy country like that, and I don't even speak the language and all these things. But I tell that person that I actually set up a brokerage account in, I believe it was 2012 or 2013 in Cyprus when they had that bail-in.
There you go.
The market went down by like 99%. I actually emailed, I found a broker online, and I just emailed them. And I did everything through email. I just sent them my I can't remember what I needed to send them, maybe my passport or something like that. But I just sent them the documents and it was easy. I mean, it just took me a couple hours of just emails back and forth and sending them some documents. They set it up. I wired them the money from my account and they bought whatever I wanted. And I still own those shares today. It wasn't this daunting process that we should all
be afraid of. Don't be intimidated.
At least that was my experience in Cyprus. Maybe it's different to other places.
No, there's plenty of places like that. It's not universal, but I say that to people too. Like they email me and say, oh, but you know, you're doing all this stuff and you're talking about it, but it's all great in theory, but I mean, I can't do that. And I actually email them back and say, well, why not? You know, I'm a regular guy too. And that's how I started and did it. So don't be intimidated. You know, you just go through the procedures, and a lot of these guys are more than happy to have foreign clients, and the procedures are actually not as onerous as they are in the US and other places. You know, they don't want to know your whole life history. They obviously want to make sure you're who you say you are, and your money doesn't come from a dirty source, but that's really all that they need to find out. And it's quite refreshing. It's like the old days. You know, it's much more personal. Speaking with the brokers in Tanzania, you know, I went and met them, and you know, we build a rapport and off we went. But you can do a lot of it online. And this Momentum Securities that I mentioned in South Africa, I went through the procedures there to test it out. And I mean, their service was terrific. So don't be intimidated.
That's great to know. So I want to just go back briefly to these. I know our time's running short here, but to the dividends, because
Yeah.
Whenever I'm talking to people, they always ask me my advice. And I say, listen, I can't give you personal advice because I don't know your situation, but I can just tell you what I do. And I didn't know anything about investing prior to 2012. I just had to kind of teach myself.
Sure.
One strategy that I came up with, and I'd love to get your feedback on whether this is crazy or maybe there's something to it. And I always said, okay, I'm just going to divide my portfolio into three buckets. So I'm going to have one bucket is for what I would call insurance. Yep. I would have another bucket for investments and another bucket for speculation. So I define the insurance by just really just physical gold. Yeah. I'm just trying to protect some purchasing power there. Sure. The investments is something I would buy that has to pay me to own it. So whether that's a rental property, whether that's a dividend paying stock, I've got to be paid to own it.
Yes.
And then the speculation is just, I'm not being paid. I just think there's a lot of asymmetry there. So uranium might be a good example of that. Yeah. And I just do 10% insurance, 80% investing paid to own, and then 10% speculation.
Yeah. Well,
what do you think about that from a professional standpoint?
That sounds very sensible to me. And I think some people, the speculation is important because a lot of people, you know, that's what you enjoy doing. And, you know, it adds a bit of pizzazz and gives you something to talk about at cocktail parties. So I think anyone who plays it too safe in stocks is probably not being true to themselves. You know, you do need to have a speculative element to your portfolio. And I do that with small mining companies, you know, exploration stock, mostly in Australia. Canada, obviously, is a huge market for that as well. But yeah, I mean, that's a perfectly good strategy. And the investing bit of the portfolio, as you say, the cash flowing investments, I mean, how can you go wrong? If you own a great business that's paying lots of dividends, or you own a great rental property that's paying back more cash than you fund it with in the mortgage, I mean, that's a sensible way to long-term wealth creation.
Yeah, and so on that dividend note, I know a lot of people, they love a dividend play. They love to get paid, but they're like, well, if I'm getting a 10% yield or 10% plus, there's got to be a reason for that, most likely. They're going to stop paying the dividend for XYZ reason. But I'd like to kind of point out to people that might not have traveled extensively outside the United States that in these countries, and I'm going to specifically point out Colombia.
Yeah.
Almost every one that I've been to like that, I've been to over 40 countries, they always have like their local beer. As an example, and it's just a staple, and it's on the the soccer uniforms, and it's not going anywhere. Like in Colombia, it's called Club Colombia. Colombia has, I don't know how long it's been in existence, but I can promise you it's going to be there for the next however many years, because it's just it's part of the country. It's part of the whole culture, almost. So we're in these countries that you look at in Asia, and more specifically Africa, do they have companies like that are just a cultural staple of the country? And there's there's not a 0% of them cutting their dividend, but the chances of them cutting their dividend are just incredibly, incredibly low.
Exactly. You hit the nail on the head. So another fund manager in this space, a very interesting German fellow originally, he migrated to the US. He's out in California. He and I compare notes sometimes. And his strategy when he first started in these frontier markets was to always buy booze, banking, and cigarettes. And because people need all those things, or you don't need to smoke cigarettes, and that's thankfully going out of fashion in a lot of countries. But yeah, exactly right. So in the markets where I'm looking, same thing in Tanzania, it's Tanzania Breweries Limited. You know, that's the biggest blue chip stock. In Kenya, you got East African Breweries Limited. The company I actually personally think is probably the best beer company in Africa is Namibia Breweries Limited, down in Namibia. They have a really great beer too, besides anything else. It's great. It's probably beer o'clock where you are, actually. It's early in the day with me. Yeah, so those kinds of companies here in Indonesia, a lot of people still smoke. I think about 80% of Indonesian men smoke, and I actually own one of the tobacco companies here, HM Sampoerna. It's part of the Philip Morris Group. Not much chance of that dividend being cut. So you're exactly right. And as these things compound over time, I mean, you might have bought it 10 years ago, and 10 years later, all of a sudden you're collecting double the dividend that you were back when you bought it. So your yield has actually doubled in that time. And people don't...
Based on your cost basis.
Yeah. So, based on your cost basis. So, you know, in a lot of these frontier markets, the returns available on investments are just that much higher. So dividend yields of 10, 12, 14%, you shouldn't compare them to companies that yield those kinds of dividends in the US or other developed markets, where usually there is some kind of financial engineering at play to be able to you know, juice the dividend up. And that adds to the risk. The reason that you get these big numbers in a lot of these other countries is simply that the investment opportunities are still there. You know, the returns on capital that you can get are very high because these countries are not flush with capital. So that's a great thing for your readers to think about, your viewers to think about as well, is that, you know, you have your capital, you might be able to generate, you know, 10% return on it in the US, but if you go down to Colombia, all of a sudden, you know, a whole different world opens up. Same in Africa. A lot of guys with entrepreneurial business ideas, but not much money. So if you come along and you provide the money and the expertise, you know, that's a real opportunity. And that can be both in listed and in unlisted investing spaces.
All right. Well, man, I love this stuff. I really enjoy frontier markets and emerging markets and just opportunity outside of kind of the mainstream. It's just every investment that I've made in my life since I retired that I've done very well, they've had one thing in common. And that's when I tell people about them, they tell me that I'm absolutely crazy. You're yes. You're insane. Why would you do that? And the ones I've had a couple where I've got my butt handed to me, and sure enough, every single time I've lost money in an investment, it's ones that I tell people about them, and they say, "Oh, well, that's a great idea." Well, yeah, you know, those are always ones where I've lost. So
interesting.
I'm really a fan of the stuff you're doing, Tim. For my viewers and my listeners who want to find out more about all the stuff you're doing, where you're writing these blog posts, what you do for Sovereign Man, this fund that you've set up, where can they go?
Okay, so sovereignman.com is probably something that a fair number of your viewers are familiar with already. Yeah. I mean, we write about sort of internationalizing your lifestyle and investing opportunities all around the world. I have another site called Global Value Hunter, where I'm looking for good deals, not only on stocks, but on lifestyle things around the world.
Great.
And the African Lions Fund is the new fund that I've set up, africanlionsfund.com. So those three places are easy places to find me. And I'm also on Twitter at Global Value Hunt is my handle there. I think we probably follow each other, so I may come up in your feed and vice versa, probably with this video, I guess.
Yeah. All right, Tim. Well, that was a really cool conversation. I'm excited to kind of check out Africa now and follow what you're doing.
Yeah, come visit. You know, it'll be fun.
I would love to come visit. I just got to get. We got to get over this COVID thing. It's impossible.
So
fly right now.
Thankfully, Tanzania is wide open, so I'm headed there on Friday. Yeah.
Is it? But locally, are the restaurants and everything open?
Yeah, I spoke to a lawyer on the ground over there that I'm doing some business with, and he said it's been totally normal since about May, late April, early. Yeah, so they had an early wave of infections and there was stuff going on, but he says it's completely back to normal. So that's encouraging to know.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Good to take precautions and be careful, but I'm enthused that you know, I'll be able to go and sort of live normally over there, hopefully.
Yeah, for that. Yeah, that's something that I'm looking for right now as we speak. I was in St. Bart's and I was really enjoying it over there because they're pretty much business as usual, but I've come out of Puerto Rico to get my license renewed. My gosh, I mean, you can't go out anywhere on a Sunday. They've got a curfew here. It's like being a teenager. I mean, it's just...
Hopefully it all fizzles out soon and we can get back to normal. Exactly. Fingers crossed.
All right, Tim, I appreciate it and I can't wait to do it again.
Thanks, George. Great to speak with you and thanks for having me on.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.